I invite you to follow along with me in your Bibles. And so the first place you want to turn to is Genesis chapter 12. You can follow Israel's journey during the wilderness wanderings in the Bible, or you can follow Israel in the land by using the Bible as a guide. And in July, that's what four of us did, at least for a little tiny part at the very end of their journey, as we traveled from Mount Nebo to what is the oldest city in the world, the city of palm trees, the city of Jericho. And it all begins with a promise that God made to the great patriarch Abraham in Genesis 12. When you're reading Genesis chapter 11, Moses, the writer of Genesis, shows what happens at a place called Babel, where the earth was all in one location at this point, the people of the earth, and they wanted to build this tower that reached up into heaven, but God had said he wanted them to spread all over the earth after the flood. But they refused to do that, so he dispersed them in his own way by creating the different languages that eventually turn into the different languages of the world today. So they couldn't work together anymore on their great project, and so they begin to spread over the earth, going down into, you know, into Europe and into Asia and into Africa and other places. And at towards the end of chapter 11, he then tells you about Abram, the one God later called Abraham, and you see his movement. Why is he moving from Ur of the Chaldees, modern Iraq? At that time, it was on the Persian Gulf. The two rivers of Tigris and Euphrates have dumped enough silt into the Persian Gulf now that Ur is now way inland. So they're traveling up through the two rivers, and then they're dropping down into the land of Canaan. And why is that? Well, that's chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. I frequently give you verse 3 because it's at the end of verse 3 where God makes the promise to Abraham that in him God would bless all the families of the earth. But that wasn't the entirety of his promise. In verses 1 and 2, he had also said this to Abram: get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And so the Lord, or Abraham, did as the Lord told him to do. That's why you see him moving in chapter 11. And then he finally gets to the land of Canaan, and when he gets there, the Lord showed him the land. And verse 5 then says that Abram took Sarai, his wife, later named Sarah, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were then in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai, or I, on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. So he's covering all of the land of Canaan. Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons plus a daughter. Those 12 sons eventually grow into the 12 tribes of Israel. But before that happens, the family grows to 70, or about 70, and they move to Egypt. As the children of Jacob grew mightily in number in the land of Egypt, the Egyptians begin to fear the Israelites, thinking, wow, they've become so large in number that if an enemy attacks us, they may join the enemy. And so at that point, Pharaoh decided to enslave the children of Israel. And you want to turn over to the book of Exodus right now, because there in Exodus, it's important for us to notice what it was that the Israelites were doing in the land of Egypt. It is common for people to say that the Israelites built the pyramids of Egypt, and that's not the case. It's probably been perpetuated by movies and different things like that. By the way, one of our local bookstores here, I went walking into their bookstore one time, and they had a sign up by the counter that said, "Do not judge a book by its movie." And that certainly goes with the Bible, doesn't it? All right. So, in Exodus 1, verse 11, we're told exactly what the Israelites did as slaves to the Egyptians. So, I don't know where people get the idea about the pyramids. Anyways, Exodus 1:11 says, "Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses." There you have it. So, they're now slaves when previously they had been in a favored position in the eyes of Pharaoh because of the work of Joseph, and perhaps you know that story. If not, please read the book of Genesis. You'll be thrilled by that story. So now they're slaves and they're crying out to God for deliverance. And so you can go back to Genesis now, chapter 15. God used Moses to deliver Israel. However, they have to wait a long time before God uses Moses to deliver Israel out of Egypt. And there's a reason for that that is revealed in Genesis chapter 15. So he didn't do it right away. They had to wait. Beginning in verse 12 of Genesis 15, it is written, "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. Then he said to Abram, 'Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs,'" the land of Egypt, "'and will serve them as slaves, and they will afflict them 400 years, 4 centuries. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge,'" which God does later through Moses with the 10 plagues he puts upon Egypt. "And afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you Abraham, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here." Now get this. "For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete or full." Okay, so in other words, the people who are living in the land of Canaan, the Canaanites, the Amorites, and a bunch of other groups of people, they're in the process of sinning. They're getting further and further away from God all the time. They're doing horrible things, sacrificing their children in the fires of Moloch, and just doing other abominable things. But God gives them the chance to reform themselves, just like He does us, just like He did Israel later in the land and so on. And it, you know, He works with them. But it finally will get to the point where he's at the end of his patience. And where the people will get to the point where they're past the point of no return. And once they reach that point, He would then use Israel as His punishing rod to drive those people out of the land. Even as, like in my class this morning, we noted that He used the Babylonians as His punishing rod against Israel. Okay, but first He used Israel against the Amorites and the Canaanites and so forth. Finally, now Exodus chapter 3, you can turn there. The time was right. And God conscripted the great man Moses. He was the man who was going to bring Israel out of Egypt. Exodus chapter 3, beginning at verse 7, shows God getting Moses ready. "And the Lord said, 'I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. So God uses Moses to take over 3.5 million people out of the land of Egypt, and they journey on to the land of Canaan. And it'll take them about 2 years to get to that border. But along the way, of course, they're going to need water. How important is water? I was just thinking about that yesterday, and I was actually watching a documentary about something about King Tut and something that was on one of his one of the things on his chest, a particular piece of glass that they've discovered comes from the southwestern part of modern Egypt that they think was formed by a meteorite, etc., etc., etc. And the place where they found this, it rains every 10 to 20 years, and it typically gets up to over 120 degrees. Very habitable. So I thought to myself, you know, you could have all the gold you want, all the diamonds and all the possessions in the world, but if you don't have water, you're dead. Same thing with the children of Israel. And we're not talking about 70 people anymore. We're talking about, I have estimated, over 3.5 million people. And God supplies water for them along the way. And I believe that he did something very special for them in Exodus chapter 17 that should have impressed them with the fact that God is going to provide for them. Even if he has to bring water out of a rock for them, he's going to show them, I will provide for you. And that's exactly what he does. Okay? Here's an occasion where they have no water. So verse 1 says, then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Then the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb. And you shall strike the rock and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. The people's attitude was one of contention and complaining. Instead of just asking, we don't have any water to drink. Can the Lord please provide us with water? They're demanding. It's like they've forgotten they were slaves and now we're the masters. Give us what we want and give it to us now. Big mistake. Well, anyways, many years go by and the situation arises again. This time, you know, they've already been to the border of the land of Canaan once. They sinned, so God made them wander around the wilderness for another 38 years, a total of 40. And this time, again, they're out of water. They're very close to the border. And so you can now turn to Numbers chapter 20. And the same thing happened again. They have no water, and their hearts are totally wrong in this. And this time, it affects Moses in a different way. Before, he was like, you know, I don't know what to do. These people are going to kill me. But watch what happens this time. I think he's thinking to himself, at least this is what I would have been thinking, haven't you learned after all these decades that the Lord's going to provide for you. He's going to rain bread out of heaven. He'll bring quail in from wherever he has to bring it. He'll bring water from a rock. Why are you complaining again? And he gets angry this time. Verse 2, Numbers 20. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and said, and spoke, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord." Okay, if we can't die in Egypt, we wish we would have died out here in the wilderness like all the others have already died. Wow. "Why have you brought up the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." Well, the Lord, being full of compassion and mercy for these people, is willing to provide for them again, to give them what they need. And he told Moses precisely what to do. So verse 7, you already heard it read, but hear it again. Numbers 20, verse 7. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the congregation together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals.' So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock and said to them, 'Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?' Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank." Well, Moses, unfortunately, let his anger get the better of him. And he didn't keep his focus on the Lord, not following the Lord precisely. And he hit the rock as before, rather than speaking to it. And he even hits it twice. I think he's just so angry at these people. But nevertheless, he lost his focus. And verse 12 shows the consequence. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, 'Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them.'" So it sounds as though the Lord's intention all along was to use Moses to bring them into the land of Canaan, and he would help them conquer the land. And Moses wasn't silent about this. He pled with the Lord to change his mind. Go now to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 3. Because, I mean, think about what he's been through for the past 40 years. I mean, he loves these people. Back when he was 40 years old, remember he saw an Egyptian beating an Israelite? And although he's living as an Egyptian at that time, he killed the Egyptian because he cared for his Hebrew brother. The next day he sees two Hebrews fighting with one another and he parts them, saying, "You guys are brothers, don't do this." And Stephen tells us in Acts chapter 7 that what Moses was thinking at that time is that they would see that God was using him to help them, but they didn't see that. So he runs away for 40 years. God gets him again when he's 80, leads Israel out of Egypt, he deals with them. Can you imagine what it would be like to lead the whole population of Oregon just through the wilderness for 40 years? What a job that would be. So, and the reason he's been given this job is to take them into the land that God's promised to them. And he wants to go. I understand his position. So Deuteronomy 3, verse 23 says, Then I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do anything like your works and your mighty deeds? I pray, let me cross over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, those pleasant mountains in Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. So the Lord said to me, enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift your eyes toward the west, the north, the south, and the east. Behold it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over this Jordan. Saying this Jordan, because they're right there. He's so close. But now the job is going to fall to Joshua. However, the Lord did let Moses see the promised land. So go to the end of Deuteronomy, chapter 34, and now listen to these four verses. Deuteronomy 34, verses 1 through 4, which says, Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, which is exactly what us four did back in July, to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the south and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. Then the Lord said to him, This is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. Okay, boys, I need all the lights off, including this one up here. So, we've left Petra in different places in Jordan, and we've now come to this. And I've told you before that I don't know if I was sleeping mentally or not on this trip, but it's all of a sudden we are in the tour bus, we're driving up this mountain, and we stop and we get out. I'm just following the herd, and boom, there's this sign. I was like, oh, this is where we're going. Mount Nebo in Arabic, and of course, as you can see in English, big bold letters. So we get up there and see what Moses saw. Whether he stood on that exact same point or not, I don't know. Let me get out my laser pointer here. This body of water right here is the Dead Sea. And unfortunately, as you can tell, it's not a clear day. I think Denise may have taken this picture. She got a whole lot better pictures than I did. So we couldn't see exactly what Moses saw just because it wasn't clear. I was so bummed about that, but oh well, that happens. So that now this is looking toward the north. You know, and so we're going looking way over here in the distance. Moses is seeing all this. And this here, let me go back. This tree is supposed to be the place where Moses hit the rock rather than speaking to it. And if that is the case, then that would mean that all of Israel was camped all around here. You know, millions of people all over the place. And they witnessed this. And so here it is a little close up. So there's obviously water coming out. That's how they farm down here now. And here's a video that I took. Trying to zero in on the Dead Sea. Notice you don't really see a Jordan River. I'll explain that in a moment. So just nothing. I was so bummed by that weather, as I told you. And I think Denise or I took this one here. Maybe a little bit better view. Denise seemed to do better at Mount Nebo than I did. a body of water there. And again, the lowest spot on earth. And actually, this little hill here was up even higher than us. I wouldn't be surprised if Moses was standing over here rather than where we were. But they had this sign up to let you know what you were looking at. You know, that Hebron, Mount Hebron was in the distance. The Herodium, which I'm not going to show you in any of my slides during a worship service. I'll show that to you at another time. I'm telling you about the Dead Sea. You know, you can look in these directions, see Bethlehem and Jerusalem. Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. You can see that on a clear day, obviously. Jericho, it was almost straight across. Lake Tiberias, which is the Sea of Galilee, you know, up that way and so on. Okay, so let's have the auditorium, just the auditorium lights back on. Okay, so finally Israel went across the Jordan. And Deuteronomy chapter 3 records the words of God that he was to speak to Moses for strengthening Joshua. Because he's got a big job ahead of him. He has to lead Israel into the land of Canaan. They're going to fight 7 years worth of wars. And then he needs to divide the land up for the people. So in Deuteronomy 3, 28 and 29, the Bible says, "But command Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which you will see." So we stayed in the valley opposite Beth Peor. And after staying there, and after Moses died, and the children of Israel mourned the death of Moses, Israel crossed opposite Jericho with Joshua as their leader. And unfortunately, I didn't get any photos at this time as we're crossing the Jordan, because I never saw a river. At one point, as we're crossing, what I'm thinking, we've got to be right down here in the valley, in the Jordan Valley. I happen to look out my window and see a waterway that is as wide as from this brick right here to the front of that seat. And then we keep going. And I was like, well, what other source of water would be running down here? Was that the Jordan River? And then our tour guide, who was one of the directors of the dig at Beth Shemesh, said, oh, by the way, that was the Jordan River. Which was really, in my terms, or way of thinking, a creek or a stream. And I found out later why that is. It's because north, they're pulling so much water out of it for farming and things, that it's a trickle by the time you get to the border crossing, and most of the time, it doesn't even reach the Dead Sea. It's either a trickle or it's just totally dry, which has a bad effect on the Dead Sea and the harvesting of salt they do there and everything. So they are taking water out of the ocean way down south, taking the salt out of it and pumping it into the Dead Sea to keep the Dead Sea alive. Well, I can't imagine how much that must cost them. But anyways, that was quite fascinating in my mind. So the children of Israel finally crossed the Jericho. They entered the land of Canaan. And now go to Joshua chapter 3. Because what we discover is that the Lord stopped the water from flowing, the Jordan, way far north. You'll see how far north it is here in just a moment on a map. Joshua 3:1 says, "Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Acacia Grove and came to the Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they crossed over." And then verse 16, when the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant finally go down into the water, it says that the waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose up in a heap, because he didn't stop the water from flowing. He let it keep flowing from the Sea of Galilee, but now he's, I don't know how he, what he did, if he just put a barrier there or if he just, by his word, said, stop. But the water kept coming, so it's piling up in this big, huge heap. And this is happening during the time of flooding. And it rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaratan. So the waters that came down into the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea, failed and were cut off. And the people crossed over opposite Jericho. So right here you can see, my lettering didn't show up very good, so that's why I added these here. So this is Jericho. They're crossing right across here. We were up here in these mountains. And Adam is way up here. At one time, I figured that was 5 miles from there to here. So I said it was a 5-mile-wide swath that he made for all these people to go across. But I wasn't including this down here. So it was a huge opening that he made. So if you ever see pictures of this or something, and they're going in practically single file, no. How long would it take 3.5 million plus people to cross any point if they're going single file or even 10 wide? No, they have to be several miles wide as they're marching across the Jordan. And what a sight that must have been to the people in the land of Canaan, because they know the Israelites are coming their way. And Jericho is the first one on the hit list. And they could see it. You're right there in Jericho. You can see where this would have happened. They would have seen this huge people massed down at the border and watched them come across. Man, that would have made my hair stand on my back if I was one of them. Wow. So anyways, let's get hit the lights again. We left Mount Nebo and headed for the border, and evidently we had a timeline or something like that, but we got to the border, I think around 6 or something. Do you remember, Carrie or Denise? And it was closed. They closed the border, although they kept letting supply trucks through, and we're just sitting at the border, and they're, you know, the guards are doing all kinds of things, and I think this was Israel that shut down the border, and they said, nope, you can't come through. So we had to turn around and go back to Amman, Jordan. And this is just a night scene that I pictured there. And the reason I did is because if I'd shown you earlier pictures, the streets are pretty bare there during the day. Because it is so... There you go. I know that you're finally getting that now. It is so hot. Carrie noticed that it was at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. The playgrounds are full of kids. They're playing because they can't during the day. It's too hot. So I took this picture because it's just like the city just came alive. Now, think about this. There's 23 of us. And they call to the same hotel and say, they wouldn't let us cross the border. Can we stay another night? 23 people. And sure enough, we went back and I don't know if they kicked anybody out or they just had a ton of rooms available or what. I have no idea. So anyways, we went back. And then the next day, we headed back. This time, everything was clear and we could go through. So we start making our journey. And here we are at the border, and I like to show you these pictures because they're serious about security over there. He's obviously got an automatic weapon. You know, they're checking out things, and I'm sure there's other guys hidden that we can't see that are ready for any kind of action coming from people who want to do them harm. And so we go down the road, and like I showed you before in Israel, I would see pictures, road signs of biblical things I've known about all my life. So to me, seeing a road sign is exciting. You know, this way for Jericho. And again, it's in Hebrew on the top, Arabic in the middle, and then Jericho, really big there in English. And so we're driving along, famous church there, and finally we arrive. And let's have the lights back on. And that's where we'll end for today. Here I am at the one end of the ancient city of Jericho. And quite fascinating what happened here. There's something, go ahead and turn them all on, please. Yeah. Everything, even this one up here. Okay, thank you. So, there are some really exciting things about Jericho. And there's something that I experienced there that I want to show you tonight. And I was the only one to do it. And it's just one of those emotional moments that you're not expecting, you know, that I had wondered about, and I'm going to show you this tonight, since 1981. When I was invited to speak on a lectureship back at my school, they used to have an annual lectureship, And it was probably Brother Hushara, the director, who asked me to speak on archaeology. I was probably only 23 at the time, I'm guessing. And, well, you'll see the point that I make. And I knew a certain truth to be so that is in the Bible, but I never knew that it would be 38 years later that I would be able to confirm that, what I'm about to talk about tonight. So please come back tonight. So all of this that we're talking about, it all starts in the Garden of Eden. God promised to defeat Satan in the Garden of Eden. And then later there in Genesis 12, we see where he recruited Abraham and his family to be the tool to defeat Satan and to save man from his sin. So he set Israel up, the descendants of Abraham, in a land where he could show his promises, his prophecies, his laws, the deadly nature of sin, where he can show the kind of God he is and all the things that the world needs to learn. And why we need to learn that when we're in sin, we're talking about a more deadly thing than we could ever possibly imagine, because it will cost us our eternal souls. And yet, he provided a most wonderful cure for that in his son, Jesus of Nazareth. That, all that we saw over there and that I'm showing you and all that the Bible is about, that's what it all is. God wants to save the world. For God so loved Israel only? No. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever, not just Israelites, but whoever, us Americans, whoever believes on him should not perish. God doesn't want anyone to perish. Even his worst enemy he doesn't want to perish. But that they might have everlasting life. And that's what he wants for you today. Okay? Do you believe in Jesus with all your heart? Are you ready to live life according to his directions? And are you saying, well, what else do I need to do? Yes, yes to those questions. You need to begin a new life. You can start it today by being immersed in water. He'll then forgive you of your sins. He'll make you like into a newborn baby in the Spirit. And you now are headed for heaven. Come forward now if we can help you.